Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And if you didn't already know this, President Obama going on a two-day swing across the country to tout his energy policies. And apparently, Jimmy's going to tout them as successful ones. That ought to be interesting. One of the things he's going to be talking about is the Keystone Pipeline, and of course blaming Republicans for forcing a timetable on him to make a decision, and that's why he rejected it, not because he's giving in to his friends in the environmental lobby. So in true Obama version of Solomonic wisdom, Obama's going to build half the pipeline, the southern half. The oil sands, however, are in Canada. Now, you might be able to make a slightly pragmatic argument saying, well, if this part's all good to go, why not start building it now and we'll hash out the details later? My guess is, though, Jim, that I'm not sure a lot of construction will happen before the election, which will give him plenty of time to go back on his word should he be reelected. The good news here, though, is the president finally sees that he's losing on the Keystone side of this debate, which has to be good for us.
Yeah. When you see a dramatic reversal like this, this kind of suggests that they must be seeing something in their focus groups and their polling numbers. We certainly have seen Obama's numbers take a tumble lately. And so to me, my most recent post on Campaign Spot talks about Obama's all-of-the-above policy. That's going to be the message of this campaign for the next 2 days, is he has an all-of-the-above policy. Well, you can't say I'm all-of-the-above, except for all these other things. All tends to mean all. That would include the Keystone Pipeline. One of the things that I'm not quite sure, I guess like you said, you compared him to King Solomon. I guess also part of his idea is to cut the gas tank in half. give half of it to the environmentalists, and you get to keep half as well. Because it's good that we're building the portion that he's now giving his okay to. The problem is, you point out, to get the oil from Canada, I guess we're just going to form a bucket brigade from the Canadian border down to Oklahoma. And that's a pretty big stretch of land that we have to cover. Even if this never gets built, we'll be driving it over trucks. How this is efficient and an improvement, I'm not quite sure. So this is a good news for us. Both in the sense of the national interest of, look, the closer we get to building this pipeline, the better it is to getting more oil to the refineries, the greater, more safe supply, and strengthen our relationship with Canada, et cetera, et cetera. The bad news is that it's half of them. And I think the real good news is that, look, Obama would not be making this move if he didn't have to. We know his instincts on this. He is perfectly comfortable with the status quo. That, you know, he's no particular desire to see this bill particularly quickly, but he must be seeing something that unnerves him to come out and make this kind of reversal and do a whole big 2-3 day energy policy tour.
And just keep in mind how we talked yesterday about how Obama and the truth are not very good friends. They don't spend a lot of time together. last night, Brett Baer was talking with David Axelrod, who once again repeated the blatant falsehood that the reason the president rejected the pipeline during the payroll tax debate is because the State Department hadn't had time to fully evaluate this yet. That is a bald-faced lie. They had it fully approved, and for political reasons, this was kicked to the curb by the president. So don't believe that for a second. The other story, of course, in political circles that happened last night, Mitt Romney not only won the Illinois primary, but won by a wider margin than even some of his most optimistic supporters suggested. It ended up being about a 12-point win. He was at just under 50%, Rick Santorum around 35%, and then Newt and Ron Paul in single digits. Eric Fernstrom is an advisor to the Mitt Romney campaign. He was on CNN, and the CNN anchor asked a pretty reasonable question, saying that, Romney's been forced to the right to some extent in this campaign because of the stronger-than-expected challenges of Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich. And so the question was, how much will that hurt Romney when he's trying to win over independents? You would think the answer would be, you know what, these ideas are just good American ideas. They're not necessarily just only for attracting conservatives to the polls. But talking about how Romney would be consistent about bringing his experience to help the American economy succeed. Instead, we get this.
Well, I think you hit a reset button for the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's almost like an etch-a-sketch. You can kind of shake it up and we start all over again.
Now, Jim, if he's talking about if he's talking about Republicans, letting bygones be bygones, banding together, the bad blood being put behind everybody in an effort to come together and defeat President Obama, that's just a horrible way of saying it. Unfortunately, it feeds into the perception that Mitt Romney will do anything, say anything, erase anything, change whatever he has to win people over. It's the worst possible message, and I can't believe this is happening again.
First of all, Mitt Romney cannot win a primary without having some sort of egregious gaffe within 24 hours. It's almost like, you know, an instantaneous, a knee-jerk reaction. I guess we can say this does pay tribute to Romney's skill as a manager. He used to make the gaffes himself, and he realized, look, I'm running a campaign here. There's no need for me to do this. He's now outsourcing it to the staff, so it's a more efficient use of his time. As Phil Klein was just noting, that if you were a Romney critic and you wanted to come up with the most effective criticism you possibly could, Etch-a-Sketch is pretty much what you would do. That, you know, right now there are a whole bunch of folks on the Obama campaign and the Santorum campaign, Gingrich campaign, who are all looking at this and saying, ah, geez, why didn't we think of that? That's the attack ad we should have been running all along. I am not that worried about Mitt Romney erasing all of his conservative stances when the general election campaign officially begins. Greg, my proposal is just to keep him very, very still. Do not let him shake or shiver or anything like that, and we should keep that image the way it is. The comparison of Mitt Romney to a plastic, flat, hollow gray product from the 1950s Midwest. No, there's no comparison there whatsoever. Yeah, it's bad. This is an unfortunate gaffe on many levels. The only way you can possibly think up about this is that, one, Romney's got to say, I'm going to be solid. I have no intention of changing these positions. What you see is what you get. Alternatively, it was John Podoretz who observed that the nice thing about campaign staffers, a campaign communication staff that puts out completely erroneous messages, is you just shake them up and they disappear, much like an Etch-a-Sketch themselves. So perhaps it's time for Eric Fernstrom to step back from the microphone and let somebody else, you know, maybe Kevin Madden or someone step forward, because it was just an... Every candidate and everybody who steps in front of a microphone will say something that comes out wrong or sounds a little foolish. But this one was just a particularly devastatingly powerful metaphor that the Romney campaign just did not need today. Otherwise, it looked like a great day. Jeb Bush is endorsing him. It really looks like he has, you know, wrapped this up. Yeah, here we go. Let's win this thing, Greg.
Well, in tennis, they talk about unforced errors. This one didn't just miss the line. It sprayed into the crowd and smacked a spectator in the face, because
exactly.
That was nowhere close to being...
There's blood in the stands right now.
...on message. But the good news for Romney is that if he does secure the nomination, which looks increasingly likely, there are no primaries between the convention and the election day. So these 24-hour zones of idiotic statements hopefully will be kept to a minimum, but we'll see. Cool.
Somebody had raised, you know, let's assume he just continues this pattern of after every win, he makes some sort of horrific gaffe the next morning. Do you realize, Greg, it's very possible that we will see on Election Day 2012 Mitt Romney win, and election night he will give his victory speech. The following morning he'll say, you know, I've always supported the English king, and I really believe that, you know, we could revert back to colonies. It could be a fascinating proposal.
Well, the other story that has captivated the nation is our Crazy Martini. It's a unique one. We don't usually focus entirely on sports, but the Peyton Manning soap opera, as he, of course, was released by the Colts. They were uncertain about his future. They got the number one draft pick, so they're headed in a different direction. So Peyton Manning visited a number of different teams. Looked from the get-go that he was pretty excited about going to Denver. That turned out to be the case. 5 years, $96 million, but of course that means the likely exit of fan sensation Tim Tebow, who, despite not the greatest accuracy, managed to win a lot of games for Denver and even provide them one of their greatest postseason moments before getting destroyed by the Patriots in the second round. So one of the rumors about where Tebow might be headed, Jim, is to your beloved New York Jets, where they think he might be able to do something in the Wildcat offense. He would not be supplanting Mark Sanchez, most likely, since they just re-signed him. And they also think he'd be great for what is, to be charitable, a dysfunctional locker room at the moment.
Yeah, my head is kind of spinning at this option, Greg. And here's why we're talking about this in a usually political podcast. Look, Tim Tebow is a fully vibrant cultural figure.
Oh, sure.
Clearly, many evangelical Christians saw a figure who is a heroic sports figure, but who also is very outspoken about his faith and has been throughout his entire collegiate career. And just has become someone who seems to be, look, you know, let's face it, professional athletes are not always associated with the very best of behavior. And here's a man who, for whom faith and being a good role model and demonstrating good character appears to be preeminent in his life. And he seems to be doing an exceptional job of that. Having said that, because of this, he has become this fascinating figure who is I believe, you know, one of the best-selling jerseys in the league, mm-hmm. and who also has this, you know, fairly solid record in winning games. But statistically, he's really nothing special. And a lot of people argue that the throwing mechanics are not. In other words, the talent to hype ratio is, some would argue, very much out of whack. So it's a bizarre football offseason in which you have the figure who many would argue is one of the best, if not the best quarterback in the game, Peyton Manning, changing teams. And this is because of age and injury concerns. He ends up going to a team that seemed to have its quarterback in place, and with the Denver Broncos. And so now, if not the most popular figure in the league, then probably one of the most passionately followed figures in the league, is now looking for a new home. And the big question will he be a starter or something? Bringing Tim Tebow to the Jets, I have enjoyed the Tim Tebow cultural phenomenon from a distance. To see someone who is this cultural lightning rod on my team is something that kind of has my feelings divided. To say nothing of the fact that, look, if Tim Tebow is, as some of his detractors like to sneer, God's favorite, boy, I don't know how I want to put God's will up against the bad luck of the Jets, because those are two extremely powerful forces. I'm not going to say that the Jets' bad luck is more powerful than God. I'm just saying I don't want to test it. So we will see what happens here. It's going to be a fascinating kind of story, and it'll be interesting to see if Tim Tebow goes to a team in a city that perhaps is, you know, dare we say, you know, red or blue. New York City is not really known as the heartland of old-fashioned religious values there. So the idea of Tim Tebow taking the Big Apple seems kind of fascinating to envision. Apparently he's already ruled out the Dolphins, so he will not be taking his talents to South Beach. Kind of fascinating to watch what's going on in sports here. We will, you know, stay tuned for your third martini of sports news if this turns out to be as wild and wacky as it appears to be shaping up.
And both of them are great citizens, to be honest about this. And so we wish both of them well in their future endeavors. I think Denver obviously is taking a gamble. If Manning takes a bad hit to that neck early on, they could be in a real world of hurt for the foreseeable future. But that's what long-term contracts are all about. You take a bet and hope it pans out for you. So we'll see how Manning does in Denver and where Tebow lands and how he does wherever he does land. So, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us for our political and sports commentary today. We'll see you next time on the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch.